This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. This is week 5 in our series on strictly contemporary dancing. And for this session, I have invited Bilkis Hijaz from My Dance Alliance to share with us a dancer choreographer, Pina Bausch, who is credited with certain characteristics of contemporary dance as practiced today. The vignette-based performances that have no linear narratives and the mixing in of other performance genres, singing, talking, all very theatrical performances.
Extremely theatrical.
First, who is this dancer choreographer?
Pina Bausch, an extremely influential, extremely well-known German choreographer. She's now dead. She died, unfortunately, in 2009. But she had a dance company of her own in Germany, in Wuppertal, which otherwise is an apparently rather unattractive post-industrial town, which had nothing much to recommend it except for her dance company. Although when she first started her dance company there, it was so shocking to the locals who were accustomed to much more classical fare that they did really think of kicking her out for a while.
She herself was trained as a classical ballet dancer, right?
Yes, she had a lot of classical training both in Germany and also she went to New York for 2 years where she...
Juilliard.
She went to Juilliard and she danced with various different teachers in New York and she continued doing classical dance there. And I think she was acclaimed as quite a strong classical dancer. But when she came back to Germany and she decided to become a choreographer, her work went in a very different direction.
Was the influence in America that turned her around?
I think it was a variety of influences. She started off at Folkwang, which is a dance school, an art school in Essen in Germany, which the dance department was run by a choreographer named Kurt Jus, who was very influential in that time. And he had really brought the German style of modern dance, expressionism, very dramatic, very dark, very, you know, proclamative, works about war and works about suffering. And he'd brought that to Folkwang. And so she was very au fait with that kind of work from her experience as a teenager, really, in Folkwang.
Even before going to America, she was, even though she was studying classical ballet and was a ballerina, she was already being exposed to a different kind of dance.
Yes, she had many different influences. And then when she went to New York, she was still continuing with some classical training. But when she went in 1960, it was a time when enormous changes were happening to the dance scene in New York and really around the world. There was a boom in the ballet community at that time because there were all these defectors from the Soviet Union who were coming over and sort of swelling the ranks of American ballet. But there was also a vast change in the contemporary or in the modern dance as it was at that time in New York City because of the rise of what we now call postmodernism in New York in the 1960s, which is really this turning away from all of the theatrical norms that you see in classical dance, like, you know, wearing a costume and dancing on a stage and looking at the audience and being a character, perhaps in a story. They threw all that away in these really radical changes. And Pina, although she wasn't necessarily part of that when she was in New York, she was definitely exposed to it.
In terms of the form, I mean, you know, when we think of ballet, it's about this form. And in the 60s was this whole notion of modern ballet established to the point that it was not just classical ballet was being offered, but a new ballet was taking root.
It's a bit more complicated than that because in America at the time there was classical ballet and there was also modern dance, which had already existed from the beginning of the 20th century. So this is, you know, 60, 70 years on, where they already had quite a long tradition of really expressive modern dance, the kind that came from Martha Graham. So at this point, choreographers are then turning away not just from classical ballet, but also from this quite already codified system of modern dance, which was very dramatic and very expressive, often told stories. Still people wore costumes, still people had characters, but they were telling, you know, they weren't telling princess ballet stories the way that the ballet was. They were telling stories about the Greek myths. They were telling stories about the gods and full of blood and guts and glory and that kind of thing. That's what Martha Graham liked very much.
So what was this departure, what Martha Graham did as modern dance? What is the dance that Pina Bausch and her immediate predecessors offered to the world?
Well, Pina picked many of these strands and sort of wove them together. So as you say, she came from a classical background. She then had the modern dance, the expressionist tradition of German modern dance. And then she mixed that with the postmodern traditions where people are not necessarily doing dance on stage. They might be doing pedestrian movement. They're not doing trained movement. They're not necessarily wearing what you expect to be a dance costume. Or they might not be standing on what you expect to be a stage. They might be doing it in a street or in a bedroom or in a gallery. So she took all of these different influences and wove it together in the kind of work that she started to make when she went back to Germany in Wuppertal.
What was the appeal of having dancers, the word that you gave was very pedestrian, they're walking across an empty stage as dance? What triggered that kind of an idea that would allow somebody like Pina Bausch to continue and get so characteristic of the kind of dances that she created?
That was definitely a hallmark from postmodernism, and it was something that people brought in because they wanted to see real people on stage. They didn't want to see bodies that you as a normal audience member really can't identify with in any way, bodies that are doing multiple turns and splits and jumping in the air and lifting their legs above their heads. None of us can do this. None of us really know what it feels like. But we do know what it feels like to walk around and around and around and around in a circle. We do know what it feels like to lie on the ground and stare into the sky. So when you see bodies doing that, you have an automatic sense of sympathy towards them that you really can't generate when you watch a pretty ballet dancer standing on point, because that's really such an unnatural movement. Pina was very interested in the real world. She was very interested in reality, and she didn't want to cut out all of these things and say, oh, I'm not interested in that. So, for example, one of the great influences that she had on her work, or influences that she had on other people's work, was having these massive, enormous sets, which no one had really seen outside the opera in Europe, certainly. And the first one that she had was when she choreographed Rite of Spring in 1975, where she had several tons of black earth spread sort of a foot deep across this enormous opera stage. And the dancers danced in that.
In that mud.
In the earth. And so at the end of it, they were filthy. Their clothes were filthy. Their faces were filthy. They were covered in it. But she wanted that because it was reality.
The version that I saw on YouTube, it looked like still a very clean stage.
It was clean in the beginning, and then they dumped earth on it, yeah. They start off very clean. They start off perfectly pristine, and then by the end of the work, they are just filthy.
Let's hold that for a while. You suggested that she wanted to do something that the audience can identify with, and yet she has said this thing. I don't know how that would fit into what you've just said. She said, it is almost unimportant whether a work finds an understanding audience. Straight away, that seems to suggest that she does what she wants. And to some extent, that means that what the dancer choreographer wants and what might be understood of by the audience is irrelevant.
But they can be something totally different. And this was perhaps also something she picked up in New York City, having seen perhaps the works of Merce Cunningham, who, when he was working with John Cage, they separated entirely the music and the dance. And then during the performance, they put it together, but the dancers had never heard the music. So this kind of chance accumulation, Merce Cunningham as a choreographer, he wanted the audience to find their own associations through the piece. The associations were not created by the choreographer because they'd never heard the music. So whatever happened during the show was something that the audience noticed and was a pathway through the work that the audience made for themselves. And this was really what Merce wanted, was for the audiences to take some kind of agency in watching the work, not just to sit there and have this piece given to you. This is what it is. This is what it means. This is what I intend it to mean.
So what's informing these choreographers? What was happening in the air? What was the zeitgeist that has created this kind of ideas to say, look, it is no longer our responsibility. You, as the members of the audience, you have responsibility in watching. The way you watch, how you engage It's you. Yeah.
Well, this is perhaps just the global phenomenon of postmodernism, which I think recognizes what we call the death of the author, that it's no longer about what the artist wants you. It's not about the genius of the artist. It's about how it is received and the many different ways that it is received by the audience, what the audience makes out of it, which is never the same between two people. And that's the genius of the creative event. The creative event happens not just or not merely within the eyes and the sort of structural power of the artist, but happens when the audience member looks at it, and in the mind of the audience member itself is where creativity occurs.
One of the things that she made popular was this thing about narratives which are not linear. And narratives which are not linear, in a way, not only create space, they provide a huge gaps which the
audience has to fill in. Yes. Has to fill in or doesn't. Maybe just goes home and goes, I have no idea what just happened. I have these like discrete memories of the show. I have no idea how they fit together. And maybe that is the impact that you get. Or maybe you think, oh, in the first scene I saw this woman playing a harmonica and she was playing a children's song. And then in a later scene there was a scene where adults appear to be playing a children's game. And so maybe there's a running theme through this which is about looking back at childhood and how those things inform our daily life. Maybe you'll get something like that, or maybe you won't. And that's the fun of it.
No, we tend to go to performances based on my understanding of watching how people watch productions, is that I go and see something, I want to know what it is I see. This whole notion of not really knowing, and as you said, the death of the author, therefore the death of the choreographer to some extent.
Yes, exactly.
With this throwing this at the audience,
is it
a relinquishing of responsibility?
I think of it more, you can think of it that way, but I think of it more as a degree of growing respect for what the audience is capable of doing. You're not talking to children. You're not telling fairy stories wherever this means this and that means that, even though actually fairy stories are not like that. You are talking to adults who have perfectly functioning minds and who are able to make connections and who don't need to be spoon-fed. Perhaps in Malaysia this is still something of an alien concept, but really this is what contemporary performance of all kinds is about.
It is about the performing arts reflecting a kind of democracy, a breaking down of a hierarchy between performer and audience.
Performer and audience and artist and audience, yes. I think still here in Malaysia we have this great culture, well, we have a great culture of respecting authority in all forms that it comes in. And that also extends to respecting the authority of whoever is acclaimed to be a great artiste. So we tend to look at them for answers and we look at them for truth. And perhaps their job is not to provide us with truth and answers. Perhaps it's just to provide us with questions. And we must fill in the gaps with our own experience and our own lives.
Well, I cheated a little bit when I read the quotation, when I said, according to Pina Bausch, it is almost unimportant whether a work finds an understanding audience. One has to do it because one believes that it is the right thing to do. But then she adds, we are not only here to please, we cannot help challenging the spectator.
Yes, and it is a challenge to the spectator. But to me, that's what is so exciting about contemporary dance, is that you are never quite sure what you're going to get. You're never quite sure what you're supposed to think of it, because there isn't a supposed. There isn't a, this is the template and you're supposed to aspire to this template. Actually, what you get out of it is what you get out of it, and that can mean many different things.
I'm speaking with Bilqis Hijaz of My Dance Alliance, and we're on Strictly Contemporary Dancing. Today's show is the fifth in the series, and the subject today is Pina Bausch. Coming up, a closer look at the dancer choreographer's Rite of Spring. This is Front Row, The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. You're tuned to Front Row, The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. My guest today on the fifth part of our series titled Strictly Contemporary Dancing, Pina Bausch, is Bilqis Hijaz of My Dance Alliance. We've been talking about Pina Bausch. Let's start with this very famous piece, The Rite of Spring. When that piece of music was composed and then the dance performed with Nijinsky, it was
In 1913, that was,
It was at that time considered something revolutionary. It was very new. The music itself was very new, so new that some folks walked out and said this was rubbish.
People actually threw chairs, I believe, really? In the theatre in Paris at the premiere of the work. There was lots of shouting. People stood up and shouted at each other. Half the audience wanted the performance to stop. The other half of the audience wanted the performance to go on. And the orchestra didn't know what to do, and the dancers didn't know what to do. And the choreographer was standing in the wings and sort of yelling at the dancers to tell them to go on. And yeah, it was bedlam. It was popularly known as a riot.
And now it's seen as like this canonical work.
Well, it is. When we hear it now, we think, oh, goodness, what a very classical work. And how did people object to that? Because it's played by a classical orchestra and it's scored in a classically Western way. And it seems to us to sound like classical music. But at the time, in 1913, it was completely revolutionary because the music alone, it didn't have set counts. It is very difficult to count. And it had very loud, very strange percussive effects that, to Parisian audiences at least, sounded barbaric, sounded like primitive tribes, and you don't bring that into a Parisian theatre.
In terms of dancing, though, when you don't have a very strict count, what does that do to dance?
Well, it is a very strict count, but it's not a regular count. So it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. It goes 5, 6, 3, 7, 11, 6, 6, 6, 6, 4, something like that. So it's incredibly difficult. Nijinsky and Pina Bausch have stuck very closely to the music. So they counted every 3, every 7, every 11, every 6, 6, 6, and learned it, and the dancers learned it. And then they did movement exactly to those incredibly irregular but set counts. A lot of choreographers who take Rite of Spring might be like, oh, well, this section sort of sounds like this, so we'll do this kind of thing, but it's not exactly timed to it. But both Pina and Nijinsky's preference was to set the movement very close to the actual counts of the music, even though it was incredibly difficult.
What about this dance that she did? Since the dance was already choreographed before.
There had been several versions of it since Nijinsky as well, yes.
Why did she do this?
I think she saw in it a story or an effect that still moved her and still had the capacity to move society greatly. So the basic story of the Rite of Spring is of a village, that it is embracing spring, but in various traditions around the world in extremely sort of anthropological times, there have been traditions of shedding blood at the beginning of spring in order to bring back a spirit of fertility into the fields to sustain life for the coming year. And often this is just a sort of ritual shedding of blood. Perhaps you sacrifice an animal. In some places, it was the practice...
The virgin.
The virgin, or in fact, the king. You would have a king for a year. And at the end of his year, he would be sacrificed. In this case, it is about the sacrifice of a virgin. And a virgin woman is chosen from the village to be sacrificed in order that the spilling of her blood will bring in the fertility of the new year. So that's what the work is about. It's about the anguish of the chosen one. And it's also about the feeling of dreadful determination of the villagers who know that this is the way it has always been done and this is the way it must be done. It is about violence, it is about sex, it is about death, of course, above all of things, but it is about sacrifice for renewing life and renewing the cycle of life.
In this choreography, did she depart much from what she's now known for?
This was quite an early work of hers. So she created this in 1975 when she was still quite a young woman. And this was the first big work of hers that acquired real international influence and fame and really made her name. But it was actually quite different from the works that came after, and she had quite a prolific career and created many, many enormous full-length works for her company, which were quite different. So Rite of Spring still has a very clear story, and it still has very clear characters, and you can look at it and watch it and think, oh, yes, I know exactly what's going on now, really. Whereas later she departed from that and she introduced what she became most well known for, which was this kind of vignette style, where a full-length work was composed of various different scenes that might have nothing to do with each other or look like they ostensibly had nothing to do with each other. And again, it was up to the audience to figure out what those connections were. Now we look at contemporary dance with its vignette style, and a lot of audience members feel very uncomfortable with it. They think, oh, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what I'm supposed to think. Where's the story? I really don't get it. And they think, oh, this is too experimental for me. I really can't handle this. But if you look back to 1913, when this piece of music was made, that's what audiences thought then. This is too experimental. I can't handle this. But we, listening to it now, think, oh, that's a really rather pretty piece of classical music, even though, yeah, it's a bit stompy at some points, but we accept it. So I think what we think of now as being unacceptably experimental, in 50 or 100 years, they'll look at that and think, oh, yes, that's perfectly understandable.
So what does that say about us, that we just need time for things to sink in and then you say, oh, now I understand, or now I have a way of accessing this piece of information, if yes. Information is the right word to use even, or that now I have a way of accessing this stimuli.
The stimuli. Accessing, I think, is really the way that we have to look at it, that we have to allow ourselves to open the door and to go through it, and not to necessarily feel like we have to know what's on the other side. We ourselves as audience members have to be a bit more comfortable with taking risks with our own perceptions and with our expectations of what we will see in the theater, and allow ourselves not to understand sometimes and become perhaps more comfortable with that lack of understanding.
In fact, if we were to see Pina Bausch's Rite of Spring today, it would be quite accessible, quite easy to know what's going on. In fact, it looks a lot like modern ballet.
It is. It's a very modern dance kind of work. And I think most audiences do find it very accessible. This, ironically, is why Rite of Spring remains a real favorite out of her entire repertoire. It is the one that now, almost 10 years since her death, is still being performed all the time. I mean, we have a dancer from Malaysia, Raymond Liu, who trained at the Folkvang Academy in Essen, where Pina Bausch was trained, and is a choreographer in Germany. He often comes back here, but he's going back to Europe to dance in a version of Rite of Spring, because still there are companies and festivals around Europe who demand this work, because it's an incredibly accessible work now.
Compared to something that she came up with just a few years after, Café Müller. And the whole notion of getting dancers to move on stage with their eyes closed
is and then, kind and of incredible.
On top of that, there is furniture.
There's furniture. It's a cafe. It looks like it. So in this case, she has this enormous set, which has been perfectly created to look like the inside of an old European cafe. So it doesn't look like a theater anymore, really, in any sense. There are all these tables and chairs. It's full of tables and chairs. And there are dancers who are dancing with their eyes closed. Yes.
Yes. And of course, when you have dancers dancing with their eyes closed, there is risk. It's not just an empty stage. It's a stage with chairs and tables.
And I think she embraced that idea. She also embraced the idea, and again, this goes back to sort of a lack of logic, of dreaminess. And Café Müller was really very much about dreams. It was about sleeping. Part of the inspiration for that work was her experiences as a child. I think her parents owned a cafe.
Cafe, right. A boarding house of sorts where their guests would stay there.
And she remembers spending hours hiding under the tables of the cafe, which presumably had tablecloths on them, and listening to the conversations of the adults around her who didn't know she was there, and sometimes falling asleep under the table and then waking up again and hearing a different conversation. And so this sort of dreamy accumulation of impressions and sort of childlike innocence coupled with a kind of adult knowingness is what I think she was trying to bring to Café Müller.
For most plays, folks go to scripts, and then from the scripts you work towards the final product that you will show on stage. But in the 20th century, folks have moved towards this whole notion of devising.
Yes.
Is this something that choreographers have always done, in that you are always devising? You don't have a script to begin with.
Well, In the modern sense, yes, it is. In the classical sense, you would begin with a libretto. You would begin with a story that might have been written by somebody else or might have been written by you, and then you would follow that story in a
But the story
a
doesn't
ballet.
give you a choreography in the sense
no,
of...
No, but it gives you a general guideline of what you need to achieve in this scene. The prince falls in love with the princess. In this scene, the evil magician turns up, whatever, something like that. And so then you have a basic idea of where you're going. But yes, in contemporary choreography, it is all devised. And a lot of it is devised with the dancers themselves. And this was something also that Pina was very fond of. A lot of the movement that is in her work, and it is often very dancey, is derived from the dancers themselves. She asks them for memories on a certain topic. They talk about these things, and then she asks them to create movement around this memory, and then she will shape it and edit it and put it together and transpose it, juxtapose it with different elements. But the original material comes from the dancers themselves and is about their lives.
To some extent, here it's no longer the director telling or the choreographer writing up the choreography, but getting the dancers to...
Facilitating the dancers, really.
Yeah, it's a facilitator's role. Yeah. Again, here, the hierarchy is broken.
It is to a certain degree, although I think if you talk to Pina's dancers, you will realize that she maintained her authority to... I mean, it may have been their ideas, but her word was law.
Looking back at her corpus, what were the themes she worked with?
A lot of people, especially in America, when she eventually took her company on tour to America after she'd already established herself as a very well-known choreographer in Europe, found her work to be very misogynistic because they observed a lot of brutality between male and female characters, and they observed the male and female characters to be extremely separated on stage, which they are. The men often wear suits. The women often wear ball gowns and high heels. This is a kind of iconic now image of a Pina Bausch work, is the characters dressed in this way. And the men often gang up against the women and do something against one woman, and the women often gang up against the men. There's often this feeling of like male-on-female play, or they're playing some kind of obscure game that you're not quite sure what the rules are. It may start off innocent and then it becomes quite brutal, and you're not quite sure when it sort of crosses the line between innocence and brutality. That's often a hallmark of the kind of work that she makes.
What are her influences? Who follows her now?
I think there is no contemporary dancer now working in the world who is not in some way influenced by Pina Bausch, whether or not they actually know that, and whether or not they can trace the degree of influence that she has had. But she was so major in the European scene and for so long that it's really not possible not to be influenced by her. Most choreographers are using this kind of vignette style. She didn't start it, but she certainly popularized it.
Do you like what she does?
Okay, so mea culpa, I have to admit that I have never actually seen any of Pina's works live on stage, which is of great sorrow to me. But now that she's dead, her company is still continuing and they still do some of the work that she created. But I think they also would admit that it is very different now that Pina is dead, and it's difficult to see a work now in the same context that it was made. So I can't really speak from personal experience, but I speak from the sort of the snippets of work that I've seen and the influence that I feel that she's had on other people.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sun Heng. It's always a pleasure to be at BFM.
I've been talking to Bilqis Hijaz about Pina Bausch. And if you have any questions on contemporary dancing, do write to us. Or if you have questions about music, theater, the visual arts, write to biggerpicture@bfm.my and we'll try to address them. Join me next week when I will be talking to Joe Kukadas and Zafin Fuzi on the theater. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.